Hey everyone, welcome back to Lift Every Voice. This is Kristen and Monica from Cory Booker's Senate office here in Washington, D.C.
It's June, which means it's graduation season, and this episode is dedicated to celebrating the amazing class of 2018 and all the graduates out there.
Last weekend, we had the privilege of going back to our alma mater in New Jersey, Princeton, to hear Cory deliver the graduation speech. For us, it was a moving reminder of why we got into public service in the first place, and how true power is never about positions or titles on your resume.
So we wanted to share with all of you Cory's graduation speech that we got to hear in person, with the hope that as the great class of 2018 goes out into the world to achieve all of your ancestors' wildest dreams, that you never forget the breathtaking power of love.
Hello, everybody. I cannot tell you what it means to me to be invited to be here with you graduating. I want to say, first of all, that I want to give gratitude to the folks that actually thought to invite me, to some of your student leadership. But I also, on this day, think it's really appropriate to give thanks to the entire community that has created this day. I want to thank all those who make up the community, especially those who often don't get thank yous, the people who manicured the lawns, the people who clean buildings, the people who scrub toilets. And I want to encourage everyone to understand on your highest moments in life, it's so important to let gratitude be your gravity. To let it keep you grounded, to understand that whatever the accomplishment is, you're not here on your own. Understanding that these folks who you see every day are integral parts of your community, that shows me the character of this class. And already, before I've even really begun my remarks, I just want you to know how special I think that this community that you all have created is. Now, I want you to know that I want to impart to you really one conclusion that may be different than you already have in your mind. The conclusion is very simple. I want to impart to you all that you are powerful. I've learned in my life that power has nothing to do about the degrees you hold or the title you have. Power is not measured by position. I want you to understand that you're powerful in a way that one of my favorite authors wrote about when she said the most common way people give up their power is not realizing they have it in the first place. These words are from Alice Walker, who wrote powerfully and movingly and compellingly about what real power is. I want you all, hopefully at the end of my remarks, to think about your power in a different way. And as you strive to put more lines on your resume, to realize that that resume will never ever reflect the truth of how powerful you are. I want you to perhaps do like I do, which is to reject the great man theory of history, which writes about powerful people in powerful positions with powerful titles that moved our nation forward, and to actually remember that this nation was shaped and formed most by the people you're never going to read about in history books. And I want to exhibit this in a simple story that really has two parts. One part of the story I've known all my life, and the other part, the second half of the story, I learned about in recent years that just knocked me over. Well, the first half of the story I've told many times. It's sort of my origin story, which I bet for a lot of people in your audience, because all of us come from humble backgrounds, if you go further enough back in our family trees, there's difficulties, there's oppression, there's poverty. And for me, I heard about it all the time growing up. It was my father and my mother telling me about their humble backgrounds. Now, my dad had this way of exaggerating his childhood. It's like, you know, son, I was poor. But now he would heckle me if he heard me and say, don't tell those people I was poor. I was just Poe, P-O. I couldn't afford the other two letters. I was just a Poe boy from North Carolina. And my father's crazy. The weather, I never wanted to go to North Carolina because I thought it was just always outrageous. And one day he started a story by telling me, son, let me tell you about the time the tsunami hit my town. And I'm like, Dad, you're from the mountains of North Carolina. There is no way a tsunami hit your town. He's like, boy, don't you disrespect me. You know the Bible, thou shalt honor thy mother and father. It happened a long time ago, before the internet, so you can't look it up, but it happened. Well, my dad was born poor in a humble background, and yet he was able to, when his mama couldn't take care of him, he was raised by a black family in the town that took him in when he had no college tradition. In my family, was folks in a church that put dollars in a collection plate so my father could afford to enroll himself in a small HBCU called North Carolina Central. When he gets down to college and starts fighting for opportunities, he starts seeing lots of folks showing up, black folks and white folks, Christians and Jews, involving themselves in the civil rights movement, bashing down doors to opportunity. He lands in Washington, D.C., where he meets my mom, and starts to find himself, because of activism of others, not just his hard work and grit, becoming the first African American hired by this company and then that company. And then he becomes IBM's first black salesman hired in the entire Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. area. And this gets to the story. My father and mother suddenly are looking for a place to live in the New York City metropolitan area because my dad gets this promotion. And they start shopping for homes, and my mom said our guideline at first was just to find great public schools. And they ended up looking at many of the homes were in white neighborhoods, but when they would show up in the northern suburbs of New Jersey in white communities, the real estate agents would see them and then suddenly tell them, oh, I'm so sorry, that this house, it's already been sold. Or, oh gosh, the homeowners decided to pull it off the market. They're not going to be sold. They were literally steered away from white communities. And my parents were frustrated, so they looked around and they found this small storefront operation where this small group of folk, black folk and white folk, Christian folk and Jewish folk, got together and decided to try to break this housing segregation. The year was 1969. I was just a baby, and my parents worked with them, and these incredible lawyers came and decided that they would actually set up a sting operation. And my parents were pretty psyched, so they would go look at a house. They would be told the house was sold or pulled off the market. They would leave, and right away, a white couple would show up, and they would find out the house was still for sale. Well, on the house that my parents fell in love with, the house that I would eventually grow up in, my father and mother showed up. They were told the house was sold. The white couple came, found out the house was still for sale. They put a bid on the house. The bid was accepted. Papers were drawn up. And on the day of the closing, instead of the white couple showing up at the real estate agent's office, my dad did and a volunteer lawyer. Well, they walk into the real estate agent's office, And the lawyer had probably been preparing his speech all day. He marches up to the real estate agent and says, sir, you are in violation of New Jersey Fair Housing Law, and starts to give him this great, powerful civil rights speech as my dad sat there and said, yeah, yeah. But then all of a sudden, the real estate agent stands up and punches my dad's lawyer in the face. And sigs a dog on my dad. Now, let me tell you right now, every time my dad would tell the story, the dog would get bigger as I grew up. And so I grew up in New Jersey in an incredible community that was nurturing and kind, that was good to my family and I. It was an incredible privilege. I grew up with parents who would never let me forget where I came from, the struggles that went on, that I owed a debt that I couldn't pay back, that I had to pay forward, that I was where I was because of this conspiracy of love, and they told me to get out into the world, and my father was impatient. I went to Stanford, to Oxford, to Yale. My dad's like, come on, boy, you got more degrees in the month of July, but you ain't hot. Life's not about the degrees you get, it's about the service that you give. And I always say I got my BA from Stanford, but my PhD on the streets of Newark. Learning from the wisdom and the kindness of so many people who embraced me and gave me my first shot, encouraged me, changed my life direction, encouraged me to get into politics. To this day, the map of the Central Ward of Newark sits behind me in my Senate office because those were the folks that pushed me into politics, believed in me, took a risk on me. To this day, I still live in the Central Ward of Newark, only senator that lives in a low-income inner-city community because I love my state and I love her largest city. I wish we had time for me to tell you all the lessons I learned in the decade or two that I fought in Newark politics, joined spirit and soul with so many incredible people, but I want to get to the second half of the story, and it involves just a few years back when this great state elected me to be their United States Senator. It was this time, again, where gratitude should be your gravity. When you get elected to be in this position that's beyond your parents' even dreams. My mom has a saying, she says, behind every successful child is an astonished parent. And my mom was astonished. You're a United States Senator, you wouldn't make your bed, wouldn't mow the lawn. But the challenge of my going down to Washington for my mom and I was that 6 days before I was elected, 6 days before I was elected, my father died. Now, death can end a life, but it can't end a love. And my father's spirit was with me, but I missed him. I missed his presence. I missed his warmth. I missed his hugs. I missed him teasing me. I missed him making fun of me. I missed him reminding me to keep my feet on the ground, not to let my head get too big. And so in the wisdom of my mom and some of my incredible campaign team, they're like, look, the last thing you're going to do before you become a United States Senator, you're going to go to the offices and sit down with Congressman John Lewis. And I'll tell you, my mom and I went to go see Congressman Lewis, and we walked into his office. He had prepared a spread of food for us, and his office looked like a civil rights museum, except he was in every picture. And my mom and I were in awe, and that the food was laid out, and this is John Lewis. When he was your age, he was leaving his university to go join Martin Luther King. He became one of the original freedom riders. He at 25 became head of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He was one of only five speakers on the march on Washington, the last one alive. He was considered one of the bravest men in all of the civil rights movement because he got beaten time and time again on freedom rides during sit-ins on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. He had his skull fractured by the baton of an Alabama state trooper, knocked unconscious, bleeding that bridge red. This is a hero to me, a giant, and I'm sitting in his office, and the man is so humble. He is just so kind. I now serve with John Lewis, and I tell you, every time I'm with him, I'm still overwhelmed. But what is amazing about him is he is his teacher to me in what is power. You see, it's not about his title. It's not about his position. It's about the truth that he lives every day. I see the way he treats folk. They may be senators or cabinet secretaries, but I also see how he treats the folk that serve the food, that clean the hallways. He evidences to me the truth that you all should always remember, that someone who is nice to you but rude to the waiter is not a nice person. He lives this life that I talk to him and he doesn't complain. Life is not about collecting complaints or gathering grievances. And yeah, folk get in his face sometimes, but another lesson he's taught me that I share with you is, hey, you don't have to attend every argument you're invited to. He lets me understand what the truth definition of patriotism is. It's not how loud you sing the national anthem or the flag pin you might have on or all those symbols of patriotism. He teaches that patriotism means love of country, and you cannot love your country unless you love your country men and women. And he shows me that you can't lead the people if you don't love the people. He shows me that the best language you can speak is not mastery of the English language or speaking another tongue. Your first language always must be kindness. And so this, to me, is what power is about. But in that first meeting, we get up to leave. And now I'm going from one side of the Capitol building to the other side of the Capitol building to see the vice president and become a United States senator. And somebody should fact check me on this, but I think the only time in the history of America has a United States senator been walking to go get sworn in, and their mother was walking next to them, lecturing them the entire way. My mom's like, boy, don't forget where you come from. Don't forget the blood, sweat, and tears of your ancestors. Don't forget that the title does not make the man. The man or woman must make the title. And so I get sworn in. I look on both sides of the aisle to find people in Washington that are examples to me of what leadership's about. John Lewis and others I've now found that embody this ideal that the world is changed, as Pablo Coelho says, the world is changed by your example, not your opinion. And I was so excited to be in the Senate and to mix it up, to give a scrapper for the state of New Jersey. But one day I decided to do what many senators do. I decided to write a book. With a name like mine, you've got to write a book. I promise that's the corniest joke you'll hear today. And so I decided I'd go back. But if you have a father like mine, you've got to go back and fact check everything. I mean, how big was the dog, actually? And so I start going back to try to get the stories of my life and fact check them. And I go back to find the story of me moving into New Jersey, which I had told so many times. I go search for the head of the Fair Housing Council from the 1960s, and guess what? She was very easy to find because she is still head of the North Jersey Fair Housing Council today. Her name is Miss Lee Porter, and she is 92 years old, still leading the fair housing movement here in New Jersey. Now she's not representing black folks, but she's representing same-sex couples and Muslim folks who are still being denied housing because of who they are. When I brought her to my office, I'm not joking, I literally got on my knees before her and thanked her. How embarrassing and shameful, in fact, that I had never said thank you to the woman who did so much for me. Every one of us here in this audience, every one of us could probably think of people, especially on a day like this, that deserves our gratitude. Well, we started talking, and it was amazing to me. She recounts the story. She confirms facts and details. But I want to meet the lawyers who were involved in all of that struggle. I ask her for the lawyer that took a punch for my family, a guy named Marty Friedman. She says, I'm so sorry, but he passed away. But she says, look, the man who organized all of the lawyers, you can meet him. His name is Arthur Lessman, and I found Mr. Lessman thanks to her and called him up, and I said, sir, my name is Cory Booker. He's like, I know who you are. And I'm like, all right, sir, well, you know what you did for me? I know what I did. I said, okay, sir, let me hear the story. And he tells me this incredible story, and it's amazing. He confirms the fact, by the way, I found out how big the dog was. It was not a pack of wolves. And then my heart is so shocked and moved when I end the conversation by asking him the simple question. I mean, this blew me away. The second half of the story I never knew. I said to him, sir, I need to understand one thing. He's like, what? I want to know why. Why would you, at that point in your career, you were just starting off as a lawyer, you had just put out a shingle, you were struggling to make it, why would you help black families try to move into northern New Jersey? And the answer he gave me floored me. He said, well, I remember the day that I made the decision. And I go, the day? Well, what day was it? Was it, you know, July this? Or no, he goes, Cory, I remember the day. It was a Monday. And he goes, I remember it was a Monday because the day before on that Sunday, I was home sitting comfortably on my couch watching TV. It was a Sunday evening movie. I actually know the name of the movie. It was Judgment at Nuremberg. And he's sitting comfortably on his couch in Bergen County, New Jersey, watching TV, and then suddenly something rare happens. They broke away from the movie to cover the news. They went straight to Alabama because these marchers had started in Selma, led by a 20-something-year-old young man named John Lewis, and they had tried to march to Montgomery in protest of a murder of an African-American man and voting rights, and they got trapped and stopped on this bridge by a line of Alabama state troopers. And he said he watched in horror how these folks stood there and they decided that they would turn around, but first they would pray. And he said, just as they got down to kneel and pray, suddenly the Alabama state troopers shot gas in on them. He went from watching Judgment at Nuremberg to his own country as people had tear gas raining down upon them, and they got raced in by these Alabama state troopers with billy clubs, and he watched with horror Miss Boynton beaten over the head, falling to her face. Others, John Lewis' head cracked open. He said he watched in horror that this was happening in his nation, and it was just too much. He couldn't just get up and got up in a state of sedentary agitation where he was so upset about what he was watching on TV but didn't do anything about it. So he went to work the next day on Monday and sat down with the only other lawyer that was there, which was his partner, Leo. And the two of them sat there and he said to Leo, we got to go to Alabama. And Leo laughed, not because it was funny, but because it was preposterous. They couldn't afford a plane ticket. They couldn't even afford to close the doors to their business. One day they were struggling to make it. And frustrated, they just sat there for a little while. And then suddenly, in essence, they thought to themselves and said, why don't we just do the best we can with what we have where we are? And they got on the phone and started calling around, and they found this young woman with a small organization called the Fair Housing Council. They were calling around to see who might need lawyers, and when they called her, she was like, oh, thank you, Jesus, thank you, thank you. I need lawyers. And they started to get working. That was 1965. Well, 4 years later, they get a case file. He gets a case file handed to him with the two names on it, Carrie and Carolyn Booker, my parents. I've been thinking these years so often about that moment on that couch when you're comfortable, that moment in their office. I think about that moment and how these folks did not allow their inability to do everything to undermine their determination to do something. How they didn't just sit there and look at the powerful people saying powerful words and surrender their strength in that one small moment. They understood that to do nothing is not only to surrender your power, but to do nothing is actually to contribute to the very injustices that you're witnessing. That in so many ways, the opposite of justice is not injustice. It is inaction. It is apathy. It is silence. They understood that it's not enough to say, I am not a bigot. It is so important to say, I am an agent of love. It's so important not just to say, I am not hateful. You have to be an agent of love. It is not enough to say, I am not sexist, I am not homophobic, I am not cruel or mean. It must be an activist decision that you make. One decision in a world where we are so more intricately interwoven than we know, one decision by one person on one day ripples out into community. That patriotism of the people on the bridge, the love of country, which means you love all your countrymen and women, that love on that bridge, one day people whose names I don't know, standing up, unleashed that force of love into the world, and it instantaneously jumped 1,000 miles and changed the heart of one man sitting comfortably on a couch in New Jersey, who would then go on with his patriotism, with his love, with his activism, small acts, volunteering on the weekends. He would go on to change generations yet unborn. I would not be here today if it wasn't for that chain reaction of love built on one action, on one day, one person to another person. It is a virtuous virus. It's a cascade of love that we all have the power to do. Never forget that the biggest thing you can do on most every day is often just a small act of kindness, decency, love, and caring. And so, to the great class of 2018, I say again from where I started, you are powerful. Power is not on how physically strong you are, it's on how morally consistent you are. You are powerful. Power does not come from your title, it comes from you telling your truth. Every single day in your smallest of actions, what you decide to do with the dollars you spend, how you notice the dignity of the person on the street, how you give one act of kindness more than you thought. 2018, you are powerful. And I am telling you right now, if you show up, if you show up every day, no matter what's on the news, no matter what someone in power said, if you show up and you give a little, care a little, help a little, heal a little, listen a little, love, if you don't let the darkness of the world snuff out your light, if you don't let the hatred of another make you cynical and turn your back, if you live a life committed to being powerful on a daily basis, to being powerful hour to hour, with accepting your responsibility, with being an agent, then you will make your ancestors proud, because today, I am telling you, you are your ancestors' wildest dreams. But for the dream to truly be real, for the dream and hope of this country that is in the balance in this moral moment, it's going to take an awful lot of power. So my hope today is that you leave here and be powerful. Let this world feel you every day. Walk into every room. Go to every place. And embrace the world with your spirit and with your truth. And if you do that, if you live that way, if you strut like you are powerful, then I promise you that generations yet unborn will know of your light and your love. Thank you very much. Thank you.